Hello, and welcome to Anaphylaxis UK's Let's Talk About Allergies podcast, where we provide expert answers to common questions about allergies and anaphylaxis. Our goal is to offer valuable insights on how we can all work together to make life easier and safer for those living with allergies.
Welcome back to our Anaphylaxis Awareness Week series. This week, we've been focusing on our theme, the hidden battle with allergies, shining a light on the emotional challenges that often accompany allergies. It's important to remember that while we've made significant strides in understanding allergies and anaphylaxis over the years, addressing the mental health aspects is equally as important. Join us as we explore these hidden battles and empower ourselves and our loved ones to navigate the emotional landscape of living with serious allergies. In our final episode for Anaphylaxis Awareness Week, we follow up with Professor Christina Jones, a professor in clinical health psychology. Building on our conversation from last year, we delve deeper into the anxiety and stress that can come with allergy diagnosis and explore effective management techniques and coping strategies.
Hi, Chrissy.
Hi, Simon. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too. Last time we spoke on a podcast, it was about a couple of trials that you were undertaking. And at that time it was back, last year, year before. Seems like such a long time ago. Time flies. But you were doing one on mindfulness trials for parents of children with allergies. How's that gone?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. It has gone really well. We are just at the stage of revising the final article. So we hope to have that submitted to a journal soon. But we basically found that a mindfulness-based cognitive therapy intervention, which is quite a protocolized intervention, I would say. So you have 9 sessions of 2 hours every week. So it's quite intensive compared to some of our other interventions that we've been working on. We found that the parents who received the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, so we call that MBCT usually because it's a bit of a mouthful, they had improved quality of life at both kind of 1 month and 3 months compared to the control groups. We also saw improvements in worry, anxiety and depression actually at the 3 month mark as well amongst those parents. So really kind of reassuring and encouraging findings. The sample quite small because we wanted to see how feasible it was because it's such a kind of intense intervention. But we had really good recruitment and retention to the study. So it gives us hope that we can actually run a larger study to make sure that these are these results are maintained in a larger sample of parents.
Forgive me, but what's the difference between mindfulness and CBT?
Yeah, that's a very fair question. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, there are different types of mindfulness approaches, but mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and CBT, so cognitive behavioural therapy, are quite similar. They're both kind of psychotherapeutic approaches. I would say that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is slightly different in that it kind of encourages people to be in the present moment, acknowledge their feelings and experiences, and I guess without judgment on themselves. So there's quite a bit of self-compassion within the MBCT, whereas CBT is more about challenging some of those negative automatic thoughts and feelings that we have. So that's probably there's lots of differences, but probably some of the core distinctions between them.
So if someone goes to one of these MBCT or CBT training sessions, what are the type of skills that they are learning about, and how does this help them manage their allergies or deal with the anxiety of their children's allergies?
That's a brilliant question. So I would say, especially in the interventions that we've run, so these are the specific research projects that we've run, they're probably quite different. So happily talk about the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy trial first. So as I say, it's a protocolized sessions. So these are 9 weeks of 2 hours each, and they are led by a mindfulness practitioner. So these are someone who's qualified in being able to deliver that protocol. And the way we kind of adapted it specifically for parents of children with food allergies is to really explore some of the parental challenges of having a child with food allergies. We had a lot more greater emphasis on self-compassion because we know that parents experience quite a lot of guilt, and there's a lot of self-judgment, I would say, as being a parent of someone with a food allergy. That's quite commonly reported to me. We also had a range of duration of mindfulness practices. So the kind of protocol requires parents or participants to do quite a lot of work in between sessions, and some people don't find that feasible. So we really offered a range of durations. And then the other thing to say is that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was initially developed just for depression. So we removed solely the depression handouts from it, because we know that actually one of the predominant difficulties parents experience is anxiety. So we made a few adaptations, but generally stuck to the 9 sessions that is recommended within a normal MBCT approach. And then on the other hand, when we were thinking of cognitive-based therapy, we might look at specific techniques like graded exposure. So this might be when someone is avoiding going to someone's house or a restaurant or something like that, or even when we're looking at specific phobias, you know, around skin prick testing. I've done clinical work with children who are avoiding having skin prick tests because they were so worried about them. And you create a kind of a ladder of what we call exposures, so things that will get people to feel a little bit anxious and what we call habituate to that anxiety, so kind of sit with that anxiety until it starts reducing. And actually that way we build up this kind of tolerance to sitting with that anxiety and knowing that it doesn't just kind of astronomically increase. And, you know, because that's what we're worried about often, that this anxiety is just going to, you know, we're going to explode because of it. And actually what happens is we habituate. So quite different techniques, I would say, that we cover.
And how long roughly does it take if someone is coming to you with a phobia and then they're using these MBCT techniques or the CBT techniques? Is there, you know, a rough amount of time that it takes for someone to start feeling better about their phobias or going out for dinner or going to a friend's house? Or does it really depend on the person?
Yeah, that's another really good question. So I think if you were doing a full kind of graded exposure cognitive-based therapy, and certainly I've had sessions up to 16 weeks when I'm working one-on-one with clients, and that's around, as I say, specific phobias. It might be this particular person I was thinking about as a needle phobia, so we worked for quite a lot of sessions with this particular child. But interestingly, on the CBT studies that we've worked on, we are running them over 2 times 2 hours, so it's essentially 4 hours in a group setting. And what we found for up to 3 months is that people's quality of life has improved significantly. And what that's telling me is that people are probably upskilling themselves in these techniques and continue to kind of use them, because it becomes a bit of a muscle, right? The more we challenge ourselves and the more we do these things, the less anxiety inducing they become. So it is down to the individual, but I think the key to all of these techniques is it's about skilling yourselves in some of these coping strategies. And the more you use them, the kind of stronger they'll probably be, and the more helpful they'll be in terms of reducing some of those difficulties.
And do you know when these techniques will be able to be accessed by patients? So they've been told about them by their healthcare professional or their allergy consultant. Is that something that people will be able to get access to so they can maybe do it by themselves at home?
Yeah, it's a really important point. So we're talking about implementation, right, within routine care, and it's kind of our dream as researchers and clinicians that you develop something and you want it out in the kind of wide world, so that people can be using it. It's not just sat on a journal shelf for, you know, in perpetuity. So I would say at the moment, the resources that we've developed within our CBT trials, so the ones that we've looked at for children, parents and adults, we have produced the booklets and worksheets for the children population. So these were trialed in 11 to 17 year old children. And they are available via links for healthcare professionals to download them, and that's completely free. So at the moment, I think I've had 164 people download those representing about 50 odd hospitals within the UK or primary care trusts. So they are starting to be used. Yeah. I think the challenge of people just using them on their own is that that's what that they weren't developed for that. They were developed as part of a kind of what we'd call guided group therapy. So whilst they're probably unlikely to do any harm, we can't be necessarily sure of that if people are just picking things off the shelf and trying to do use some of these techniques.
Sure. Yeah.
And that would be my reluctance, but more than happy for kind of nurses, dietitians or psychologists. And we have these special interest groups and psychology working groups around allergy, and we always share these resources. So people who engage with those groups will have access to them. And the other thing that we're trying to get some funding for is to see whether we can train up nurses and dietitians within allergy services to deliver these group sessions, because we appreciate not every service has a psychologist that's embedded within them. And I think they probably can, because a lot of it, once you've learned it, is kind of common sense. So I'm hopeful that that's the movement we can go in. And then we've obviously got this knowledge transfer partnership with Anaphylaxis UK. So that would be another avenue for disseminating the resources and getting them into, you know, to the people that need them.
Certainly very keen to get that out as much as we, as widely as we possibly can.
Yeah.
Would you say, Chrissy, that, sounds as though doing it on your own is good, but doing it in a group is much better.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I suspect that if I do any qualitative research, I'm a big fan of what we call mixed methods. So it's really nice to see that, anxiety reduces and quality of life improves. But I'm really a fan of embedding some of this qualitative research. So after we've run some of these interventions, finding out what it is like for people within those groups, what's changed, what might we drop, because we know that time is precious for people as well. So if there's bits in the intervention that isn't working for people, we can just remove them. And actually, when you say to people, what was the number one psychological technique that you learned, or what's this thing that you've taken away from your experience, most of the time it's just being with other people. So that kind of, and in psychology terms, we might call that normalizing, because it's very reassuring to know that you're not the only person experiencing some of these difficulties. And I think, that's what I'm really excited about, trying to restart the support groups with Anaphylaxis UK as well, and see if we can structure those in a way which works for the facilitators and the members who are coming.
It's those practical everyday things, like which pub do you trust, which restaurant do you go to, how do you have a conversation with a head teacher. Those kind of everyday things that are particularly useful, I think, in a kind of a peer group.
Yeah.
Have you done any work around identifying, how effective are these measures depending on your age? We talked about parents. Is it useful for children? Is there a difference with teenagers?
Yeah. So having just run these kind of studies, I think we start seeing some really interesting aspects. So if I take the CBT kind of trials first that we've just finished and we've just published. So we recruited parents. So these were parents of children of any age, between 0 and 18, because by 18, children start to, be a bit more independent. So that those are the parents. The adults were 18 plus, and the children were 11 to 17 years old. And interestingly, at 1 month, you see very similar outcomes in terms of improvements in food allergy, quality of life between adults and children, and also at the 3 month mark. And for parents, you have higher kind of quality of life improvements at both 1 month and 3 months. So that's quite interesting, that actually there doesn't seem to be a difference between the individual with food allergy, but there's a bigger improvement amongst parents. That might also indicate that parents have worse quality of life actually to begin with, and certainly when we look at some of our data, that has been seen. And I guess the other thing to say is with the mindfulness, which is much more intensive course, we saw higher quality of life improvements straight away, but then they reduced at the 3 month mark. So there's something about whether those improvements are sustained, whereas actually with the CBT, the improvements got bigger over the time. So there's really interesting observations that we can start making, but these are quite small studies. So we need more data for more participants, more diverse participants as well.
So when it comes to patients with anxiety or parents with anxiety, do you tend to find, you just mentioned that a lot of research suggests that parents with anxiety seem to be more anxious to begin with. Is that generally true?
I'm not sure. This was based on food allergy quality of life. So when we were looking at those baseline scores, the baseline scores were certainly, you know, at least 1 point higher on their means than the adults. I think the children are quite similar, actually, but that's not surprising, because what we often see is if a parent is anxious, a child is likely to be anxious too. You know, you get that intergenerational kind of transmission that happens. What was interesting with the adult population is we had to close recruitment within 2 days because we had all our slots booked up. And I think that really goes to show that there really is not very much for adults at all in this space. There's more for children and there's slightly more for parents as a result. But yeah.
And for people who actually have allergies, so children moving into adulthood, do you see patterns in the levels of anxiety changing from, you know, throughout different ages?
I would love to look at that, Mary, in a bit more detail. But because of the kind of sample size, we ended up creating scores, which meant we could generalise across all the children from kind of 11 to 17. And I'd be reluctant to start, looking at subgroups, because we'd be looking at very small numbers at that point. So I guess I can't speak to that, but it's definitely something we could look at in the future as well.
We often hear stories in the news about incidences on aeroplanes, and we've all heard stories certainly through the helpline and some of the other work that we're doing about people's anxieties in restaurants when ordering food. And very often that anxiety comes across to a server or to an airline, you know, that it's kind of translated in anger that nothing's being done to protect a child or protect somebody else. And as a parent, you have that protective role, don't you? And that anxiety kind of almost goes with the job. But it clearly is made worse if the child has got an allergy that somebody doesn't think has been managed very well by a restaurant, by a business, by an airline or whoever it may well be. Do you sometimes find that although it may be the child that has the allergy, actually what you were saying there about the transfer, it's the parent's anxiety that actually is causing the anxiety amongst the child, and as the child's growing up, that anxiety is getting greater.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating point, because we when we were recruiting to those three samples, so the parent, the children and the adults, and there were a number of parents who volunteered their children to take part in the research project. And when we spoke to the children, they would come along and say, but I'm not anxious. My mum is anxious or my dad is anxious, but I'm not really anxious. So I think there's probably something about our brain and how it developed, because the part of our brain which kind of deals with consequences and that kind of forward thinking doesn't actually develop into our mid-20s. So there's probably a degree of, actually, I'm just not thinking that far in advance and things like that at that point, you know, in childhood. So there might be something like that. It might be that there's a dip where we become, you know, a bit confident in our adolescent years. We want to push boundaries, don't we? We want to kind of challenge our parents and all these sorts of things before we kind of start dealing with actually there could be quite significant consequences as a result of going to a restaurant that I haven't inquired about, or, you know, carrying my auto injectors or whatever it is, whatever safety behaviour, self-care behaviour. So I think, yeah, it would be longitudinally, I think that would be really fascinating to have a look at.
So related to that, we often
get parents asking us how they can teach their child about their allergies in a way that they can explain how serious it could be, but that doesn't scare them. And I was just wondering if you have any tips for managing that delicate balance.
Yeah, it's a really challenging balance. And I would say it also depends on the age of the child, right? You need to be communicating risks and behaviours and management that is appropriate to that child's developmental age. And also that differs, you know, what a 10-year-old manages, one 10-year-old manages in one way, you know, might be too much for a 15-year-old in some other instances. But I would say the number one thing you can do is try and role model these sorts of behaviours. So when you're in restaurants, you know, or in a supermarket, start getting them to kind of read labels, you know, start teaching them. Because what we do know, especially in parents, is that the feelings of self-efficacy, so that confidence in being able to manage your food allergy or your child's food allergy, is actually very protective when it comes to quality of life. So actually, if we can improve those feelings of self-efficacy in our children from a younger age and ensure that they're managing effectively, then actually they may not have some of those negative quality of life impacts later on down the line. And you know, draw a list of things together and create some sense of responsibility with the child as well, because I think it doesn't have to be terrifying to the child, you know, but I think trying to incorporate the management slowly into their routine is a way to kind of show them that they have some sense of responsibility and ownership of it. And it also doesn't feel terrifying, you know, when they do go off to university, because they've had that slow transition and gradual transition into taking responsibility for themselves. But I think role modeling has to be something, but you can also do things like role play, because I think a lot of children can feel, and adults actually, quite shy when they're having to have conversations about things. So actually try and get people to do those sorts of things as well, and go to places that you know are safe, as you know, so you're not anxious in that situation. I think that's the other thing. Try and keep a lid on things when you can, and also it is okay to feel anxious and overwhelmed from time to time. And I think that is also something that you can role model to your children, and to speak up. Trust your gut and speak up. If something doesn't feel right, don't just go along with it. That's the other thing I would advise.
I can't resist plugging Anaphylaxis Awareness Week, which is the first week of October, because what you were saying there really highlights the importance of that week, where we encourage people to wear it bright. Yep. And have those conversations and draw attention to it. So we're, you know, feel comfortable having those conversations. Yep. We feel it's okay to have an adrenaline pen on you. It's okay to have a conversation with a waiter or to have a conversation with a teacher about it. Mm-hmm. So wearing it bright during that week, you know, highlights, I think, exactly what you're saying there, in almost normalizing those conversations and making that, you know, that difficult for a parent to see their child leaving home, going to university, or starting an apprenticeship, starting work, or even traveling the world and leaving the home where their parent has had that control, I was going to say that, but I think that joint responsibility or direction.
I've got no evidence to support this, but it would make sense if you feel that you have also prepared your child for leaving home because of the way you've helped manage them over the years. I think you're going to feel a bit of more comfort and reassurance that you think, actually, I have done my job as a parent in that situation. Of course, it doesn't remove all of the kind of risks and worries that you would have, but at least you know you have done a good job and your child can be kind of, I don't want to use the word trusted, but you know, they do know what to do in those instances.
So we've talked before as well, Chrissy, about witnessing an anaphylactic reaction and the trauma that can cause. Have you done further work around this?
Yeah, so trauma is a really it's a really challenging one, actually. So I think it's fair to say the kind of trials that we've worked on so far are very much kind of talking therapies and what we might call low intensity. So these are not for people who are displaying, you know, very severe and enduring mental health difficulties. And I think more research is needed in the kind of trauma side of things. But we have just finished a systematic review of kind of trauma symptoms in anaphylaxis. And this is whether you've observed anaphylaxis or experienced it firsthand. And I think the really the challenging thing we found with the systematic review, and for the purposes of audience, a systematic review is where you identify the research that has been done in a particular area and you have a specific research question. So we were interested in being able to identify what outcomes are used to examine trauma, and identifying risk factors associated with trauma, and estimate the rates of trauma in, as I say, either observing or experiencing firsthand anaphylaxis. And we found not that many studies. Interestingly, I think we found 9 studies, which is quite small. And they had, that was in 3 adults, 4 in caregivers, and 2 in children. And we actually saw that within adults, between 12 and 41% experienced trauma. And in children, it was around 22%. And in caregivers, it was between kind of 14 and 57%. So they're quite wide variability there, which is why I'm a bit tentative around some of these. And they all use different outcome measures to examine trauma. So it's very hard to start drawing conclusions from them. But I think we do know trauma exists from experiencing any kind of catastrophic medical events. Certainly I've had parents talk to me about their experiences of, you know, rushing their child to hospital following an anaphylactic reaction. I've also witnessed anaphylaxis myself in a kind of a social setting and seen how that impacted on family dynamics for months afterwards. So I think we know it exists, and I'm not sure we're good enough at either screening for it specifically or knowing how to support it. And I think actually raising some kind of awareness about the types of symptoms that might follow would be helpful, because then parents or individuals themselves can say, I'm experiencing these symptoms, could this be indicative of trauma, and where can I go to for support?
So in terms of the psychological support for day-to-day allergy anxiety versus the trauma you might experience after anaphylaxis, obviously they're two different things. So would the referral for therapy for trauma from anaphylaxis be different from referral for day-to-day allergy anxiety?
I think if you are going to kind of, your generic GP surgery, they may refer you on to a trauma service, for example, but I think they would still be able to support, because the symptoms that people are experiencing are likely to be the same regardless of what the trigger for that trauma is, if that makes sense. That's different from the day-to-day management, and I think that's critical here, that distinction is different, because certainly when I've had parents email me asking for support, they have said they've gone to a counsellor who doesn't specialise or doesn't know much about the food allergy, and then it became quite tricky because the nuance of food allergy and the kind of day-to-day management and that sort of things, which we all know inside and out, they didn't feel particularly heard around that. And some, in the worst examples I've heard of, some counsellors were trying to get them to expose themselves to the food that they were allergic to in a bid to kind of reduce anxiety rather than the situation that they're avoiding, because of the absolutely correct thing of avoiding the food, if that makes sense.
I've been asked a couple of times through the helpline about having a scare with potentially having something that had your allergen in it. Maybe not having anaphylaxis, but just feeling that worry, even if it's with mild symptoms. And I was just wondering, they often talk about feeling exhausted or not themselves for a week or two after the event. And I was wondering, is that understandable in terms of the trauma that you've been through, that you would feel, you know, not yourself for a while after the event?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I'm sure all of us have had periods of kind of anxiety or depression, to whatever level, low mood, if you'd rather call it that. And they can have real physical impacts on us, not being able to sleep, being worried, ruminating, those sorts of things. And I think the other kind of interesting thing around, I mean, it's more linked to anaphylaxis, but those feelings of impending doom, you know, that's actually a physical symptom of anaphylaxis. And I think they can stay with you because you do ruminate over them, and rumination is exhausting. So I would suggest, yes, of course, your body's probably processing a lot, both cognitively and physically. So to feel out of sorts for a period of time is probably quite normal. I would also say, we don't want to pathologize the being, every kind of negative feeling after a reaction or something like that, because it's really quite normal to feel like that after things that have that you've experienced, which are upsetting or dysregulate the body in some way.
Very much, Anaphylaxis UK, that, our message is that you can do things, you can go to the restaurants, you can go on holiday, and you can go on picnics, and kids should enjoy birthday parties, and they can go and sleep over at their mates' house. So, anxiety is understandable and is there. Would you say it is inevitable?
I don't think it is inevitable. I think it probably depends how people frame things, because actually for some people, and I think of kind of a spectrum here, where some people think that never eating out or anything else is the worst thing in the world. They can't ever imagine that. But for others, they think, well, actually, I'm quite happy. I'd rather eat at home anyway. Very healthy, et cetera, et cetera. I know I don't like ultra processed foods. So actually, whilst some people might think that's really restrictive and leading to isolation, actually, some people might be really happy with that situation. And I think we do see people with food allergy being very relaxed maybe about this, and maybe too relaxed. I think that's the other thing. We do know that there's a certain degree of anxiety keeps us safe, because we're probably more likely to carry our medication with us. We're probably more likely to read labels, inquire in restaurants and that sort of thing. It's the same with a job interview, isn't it? If we had no anxiety or worry about our performance, we wouldn't prepare in any way, shape or form, right? And I think it's no different really in that instance. But I don't necessarily think it's inevitable, just because I've seen people with food allergy be, on the face of things, at least very comfortable and adapted to their situation. And I think that probably to some extent may reflect on when they were diagnosed as well. So there is some emerging evidence which shows, whilst there seems to be more support for children, they also seem to have adapted better to their diagnosis, because probably they've had that gradual transition. Whereas people who are diagnosed as adults, are kind of expected to get on with it, because they're adults, right? You know how to look after yourself, you know how to cook, just get on with it. And I think that's an interesting area which needs to be explored a bit more as well.
So on the topic of diagnosis, we are currently looking at developing an after anaphylaxis resource to help people who may have just had anaphylaxis for the first time or have a serious allergy that they've just been diagnosed with. And as you said, in children, it seems that if you are diagnosed earlier, you can potentially manage that better depending on the person. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, with adults, do you have any tips for them potentially for managing their mental health during the early stages of adjustment once they've just been diagnosed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I haven't mentioned it before now, but we are part of a group called the GAP study. So this is about the Global Access to Psychological Services study. And we have run surveys with about 3,000 carers and adults across the world, actually, to look at the kind of levels of psychological distress and the kind of barriers to seeking support. And the second stage was qualitative interviews. I think we have over 200, again, from 20 different countries. And this is about what support they would want. And now the third part of this particular project is then to design online self-directed kind of support, and one of those is around adjustment to diagnoses, because it's really important that people kind of don't feel too overwhelmed and have got evidence-based resources to be able to adapt well. I think, again, it's about understanding what is going to improve your confidence in being able to manage, because for the most part, if you know how to manage, that's immediately going to improve your quality of life. And I think when you're given a diagnosis of any kind of long-term condition, it can feel overwhelming. They don't know who to go to. And, you know, I've made cases before where, you know, on a diagnostic letter, we should be signposting to Anaphylaxis UK and Allergy UK, because whilst that, again, that's obvious to us, it's not obvious to people who have just been diagnosed. And my concern sometimes is people fall into some of the social media or forum groups which aren't evidence-based and can create actually more anxiety. So on the one hand, knowing people who have a diagnosis is helpful, but on the other hand, it doesn't always, not always is it good, and it can perpetuate issues and cause more anxieties. So I would say to anyone who has just been diagnosed, go on to Anaphylaxis UK and Allergy UK websites, have a look at the resources that are there. If you feel like you're struggling with it, you know, do speak to your DP in your first instance or your allergy team, in case there is someone within the team who can support you. There are freely available resources around to help manage kind of transition to a diagnosis and adjustment to diagnosis. Happily to kind of send the articles that we've written around this, but don't suffer in silence. Try not to feel too isolated, because that's when the kind of vicious cycle starts, where you start avoiding things that you previously enjoyed and start kind of recoiling from normal day-to-day activities, which just won't suit anyone.
I will tag the resources in the description for anyone that is interested.
Thank you as well for just reinforcing what we're doing, and clearly you're on our clinical scientific panel. You know, you work closely with Allergy UK, and I think, you know, for me certainly, it's so very important that we get the facts right.
Yeah,
there's so much nonsense that's talked about allergies. There's so much out there that tells people, well, you know, you can't do this now, you'll have to stop doing that, and you know, you can't enjoy life in the way that you should do. And there are vested interests, you know, there's somebody's trying to get something out of it, either as a, you know, kind of clickbait stuff and just self-promotion. But I'm afraid also we see it in instances over and over again when, you know, training is provided that's not right, or, you know, approaches that are done that are incorrect, because they just haven't got the backing that the likes of Allergy UK and Anaphylaxis UK have got. So it's so very important to get those right messages, and, you know, using our website and the fact sheets that Mary and the team have developed, you know, they've gone through a super rigorous process to make sure that they're done right. And now using podcasts and the YouTube and infographics and animations and the videos that we're starting to produce helps make those fact sheets more accessible.
Yeah, I would say it's a really important point you make. And what's been fascinating as part of the GAP study is to see the levels of distress differences across the world. And the UK have got quite high levels of psychological distress in comparison to some countries, like I think Spain and Germany have quite low, I say low, it's still kind of 40-50%, but the UK is kind of like 80-90% is what we were seeing in part of this study. And I spoke to some colleagues from the German equivalent of kind of Allergy UK, so they're called DARB, and they were saying, you know, we don't have, the media do not kind of circulate prevention of future deaths, you know, those sorts of things. we do see, you know, I think it's important that we learn from especially preventable deaths, of course, but they're not used in a way for clickbait and that sort of thing. And the German colleagues were kind of suggesting that that might be a reason why we see, why they see less distress.
It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. I wonder whether there is any correlation, perhaps this is for another study, you know, about the use of social media, generally speaking, you know, English speaking platforms, and whether they, you know, anybody, you know, has done any work around that connection, because information spreads very, very quickly. And those kind of clickbait headlines of tragedies and awful things happening are more attractive for a bizarre reason. I'm sure you've done some, somebody's done some work around those negative messages attracting, you know, readers more than, you know, I've got an allergy and I've gone around the world, or I've gone backpacking, or I've, you know, I go to a restaurant. Not quite the same, is it? Doesn't seem as attractive a headline to entice somebody to read or view a video.
I think, I mean, we used to call them, we still call them in kind of health psychology terms, you know, these fear appeals. And I think it goes back to what we were discussing earlier, this real delicate balance, because I think actually, you know, they're well-meaning. They are trying to raise awareness of the seriousness of food allergies and the consequences it can have. But I'm not sure the kind of unintended consequences are always well thought through. And I think that's, again, relates to that delicate balance of thinking, well, how can we ensure people know that this is a serious condition without terrifying everyone? And you know, and I don't think we've done enough in terms of risk communication. And I know there are some clinical colleagues who are wanting to do some work around this, because, you know, some of them will say to parents, you know, your child's more likely to be struck by lightning than to die of a food allergy. But parents will then turn around and say, but, you know, lightning doesn't happen 10 times a day every day, which is how often my child is putting something in their mouth. And so, you know, it doesn't always, you know, the rationality of it doesn't always translate when it's you as a parent or you as an individual. And I think that is something we need to think about and tailor it to the people that we're actually seeing.
And do you see that there is an increasing number of psychologists specialising in allergy-related anxiety and coping mechanisms for allergy? Because in the last interview, you mentioned that there were still quite few of you.
Yeah, I would say, Mary, that unfortunately is still quite not many of us. I would say what's happening a bit more, is, again, in paediatrics, so within a paediatric team, for example, someone where we might have only had one or two or three psychologists who kind of had experience, there now might be one, two or three or four or five who then have, you know, a day a week or half a day a week who are dedicated to the food allergy team to see food allergy clients. It's still not good enough, and we're still working at Surrey to kind of, because I supervise a number of clinical psychology trainees, I'm trying to upskill them at least. So if they're training with me, then they're going to get a really good understanding of allergy and other atopic conditions, actually. So that hopefully there will be more, but it all comes down to commissioning and funding as well, and whether the hospitals can make a business case for including psychologists within the teams.
Well, so we could talk forever. It's a fascinating area. But I guess in conclusion, you know, if I was to throw my hat in the ring, and you know, I'd always say that, you know, you can do those things like, you know, we all take for granted. And what we try and do as best we can at Anaphylaxis UK is help improve people's quality of life. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done to promote ourselves. I'm afraid, you know, the likes of Facebook and Google, they too need money and paying to promote, and we need to, you know, we need to get our message out far and wide. But in conclusion, Chris, I wonder, without putting you too much on the spot, and this finding, you know, this being a consultation and such, but you know, what are the tips that you might be able to share with people and with listeners that would find helpful to put these things into everyday life?
Yeah. Okay, so number one thing, familiarise yourself with Anaphylaxis UK and Allergy UK websites. I think that's the number one thing that everyone affected living with themselves or caring for someone with food allergy should be doing, because there's a wealth of information on there. I think, you know, to start really drilling down into the management side of things. So what is it you need to avoid? You know, educate yourself on, you know, trusted ingredients and things like that, trusted brands, trusted restaurants and things like that. Really equip yourself and empower yourself with the kind of knowledge, because again, that's going to make you feel protected. But don't, and I would say this, don't always rely on that. So just because you've used a brand before or for 10 years, you know, it's worth checking from time to time, because we know that ingredients change. So I think that's the other thing. And then, you know, if you are finding that you're avoiding certain situations and it's related to your food allergy, really try and unpick what's going on for you there. And then think about, actually, what else am I missing out on because of those situations? And think, you know, the pros and cons of this, and try and give yourself some alternative options. So if it's, if you find you're, you know, not going to see your friends so much or whatever it is, you know, is there another activity that you can be doing that isn't around food, or can you change venues so it's around places that, you know, that you can trust? Oh, I could keep going on, to be honest with you. I think when you are feeling overwhelmed, so at that moment, you know, doing some grounding techniques. There's things like box breathing, which can help you calm down in the moment, and that's really helpful. And there's lots of recommendations around kind of grounding techniques and breathing techniques and mindfulness techniques, which, you know, available to everyone, and you can freely download those. And again, I would encourage people to apply techniques, not just when they're feeling anxious or worried, because it goes back to that kind of muscle memory. So the more you do it, the easier it will be to kind of employ them and to start feeling the benefits of them. But if you're only ever doing it when you're in your heightened states, it's going to be a bit more difficult for you to achieve those. So I would say keep with it, and talk to other people. If you are struggling, don't struggle in silence. There are helplines available who can direct you to support. And I think that's the other critical thing.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much, Chrissy. That's great. Loads of helpful information there.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you for tuning in. We hope you found the discussion helpful and that you enjoyed our Anaphylaxis Awareness Week episodes, focusing on the hidden battle with allergies. Together, we can raise awareness and offer support for those facing these often overlooked challenges. To make sure you don't miss any episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app, including Spotify and Apple Music. Finally, be sure to follow us on social media at Anaphylaxis UK to join in the conversation, and let us know if there are any questions you would like us to answer next time.